This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Can a so-called sin tax on something like cigarettes backfire and actually harm your health? Sin taxes have been part of American policy right from the very start. Founding Father and Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton went down in history for imposing a tax on whiskey, and that was before the ink was dry on the U.S. Constitution. But our next guest says these selective or sin taxes have unintended consequences that can be counterproductive. Todd Nesbitt is a professor of economics at Ball State University in Indiana, also the co-editor of For Your Own Good, Taxes, Paternalism, and Fiscal Discrimination in the 21st Century. And he joins me now. Welcome, Todd.
I appreciate you having me on the show, Frank.
Tell us what we're talking about, these sin taxes. I mean, these are taxes, cigarettes, alcohol, but give us the scope of what you mean here.
Yeah, so sin taxes are really on items that largely have been deemed to be undesirable, sometimes politically incorrect, sometimes it's leading to poor health conditions. Notice that one of those in recent times has been on the health side, looking at sugared sodas, for instance. Certainly a lot of the gasolines and other items that lead to some environmental damage fall under these sin tax categories as well.
And the idea, as you point out, and of course there are a number of essays, you've edited a collection of essays here that talk about the various ways in which this plays out. But of course, some of the rationale behind passing these taxes, these higher levies, is to discourage the use of whatever product it is that we think is not good for us, right?
That is correct. And so, you know, largely with this book, For Your Own Good, we bring together 25 different scholars, largely just in economics, to raise the awareness of a lot of really the direct effects of those taxes in reducing some of the consumption of these so-called undesirable items, but also a lot of the secondary unintended consequences that can result as we as consumers and producers ultimately change our behavior in ways that were not anticipated by the policymakers.
Well, let's pick one. Let's talk about cigarettes, for instance. And, you know, those taxes have been going up and up and up. Let's take that as an example.
Yeah, so there's a lot of unintended consequences with cigarettes. And so I think the first we could talk about is really just looking at the cigarette smuggling that results. This is something that I think a lot of folks are not really fully aware of. But take, for instance, New York City. There, the state tax on cigarettes is $4.35. The New York City tax is another $1.50 per pack, and then the federal tax is another $1. So before a consumer there in New York City even buys or pays for the cigarettes themselves, they're paying some $6.86 in taxes alone. In Chicago, the collective taxes across all levels are $7.17. And so in some districts, there's really high taxes. But then if you take Virginia, for instance, there the federal tax plus the state tax is only $1.31. And so we have these very large tax differences across state lines. And so a lot of folks are part of these organized syndicates where they are buying mass quantities in low-tax states, primarily Virginia now, but historically North Carolina has been a primary source state as well, and transporting them up to these higher taxing districts and reselling them illegally in legal markets. And so if a consumer pays for a pack of cigarettes in a neighborhood convenience store in New York City, and they pay in cash, they're likely getting a pack that has a tax paid stamp for Virginia on it instead.
All right. So but we can't. I mean, when it comes to public policy, we don't let this kind of thing discourage us, do we? I mean, take a look at drug policy. If we don't want drugs to be sold, illegal drugs, narcotics in our neighborhoods, everybody understands that the price goes up. The amount of violence around drug trade goes up when you make it illegal, essentially more costly to do business. But we don't want this kind of behavior. And so we don't say, well, you're just going to get it anyway, and it's just going to cost more. Heck with it. Why don't we just legalize it all? We don't do that, do we?
No, we generally haven't. Now, I know that especially on marijuana, we see some momentum across various states where they are starting to legalize it and tax it in those legal markets. But primarily, states have been progressively going toward a situation where it's prohibition by price. So it's a legal product, but we're going to try to increase the price so substantially that it's just trying to discourage the consumption. But ultimately, what it ends up doing is it discourages legal purchase and then sends people into these underground markets instead.
We'll talk about that. In fact, there's a whole chapter on it's predatory public finance and the evolution of the war on drugs. And it really kind of tackles that in particular as from a public policy standpoint, a way we should frame the issues that you're trying to make us aware of.
Yeah. So with certainly with a lot of these taxes, there's you know, creating these underground markets and so forth. For instance, we estimate that roughly about 56% of all consumption of cigarettes in New York City are coming from sources outside of the state. And so, again, not legally purchased there in the state. And so this certainly creates this large underground economy. And once you take that first step as a consumer into the underground economy, it's a little bit easier to take the next step and yet another. And so it can be a bit of a snowball effect. And so really create problems there. But we also have seen that it's actually politically desirable for certain departments within our government to try to ban a lot of these items. Because ultimately, if you look at a lot of the civil asset forfeiture, which is really whenever we place a prohibition on, say, drugs, that has led to a lot of civil asset forfeiture, which is another way for a lot of these districts, a lot of the particularly police departments, to raise revenues for their department itself without having explicit taxes on their constituents.
Right. But again, this does bring us back. So when we have a corruption of the original idea, either we create an underground economy or we have various agencies not quite carrying out their, you talked about North Carolina as one of the many states where the money didn't actually go, the forfeiture money didn't go to the places where it meant. But that's a corruption of the system. I want to come back to the public policy question. If we want to discourage this behavior, don't we have a right as the public to do that? And isn't one way to do that to make it more costly, either through prohibition or imposing taxes? Isn't that our responsibility, not to just throw up our hands and say, well, they're going to do it anyway, but to say we're going to put our foot down and we're going to discourage this every way we can?
You know, I think that certainly there are valid reasons to want to try to nudge people, nudge consumers to make better decisions, such as not consuming certain drugs and other items that are bad for an individual's health. But ultimately, what we've seen is that the stick, these taxes, haven't really seemed to work. And so maybe we need to consider other alternatives. If that's our goal, is to reduce the consumption of various drugs, the taxes haven't worked, bans haven't seemed to work. Let's try the carrot instead, possibly. Certainly, providing carrots, so having various programs to encourage smoking cessation, whether that's ultimately if you get all the way through the program, then maybe here's this $500 or $1,000 at the end of the program if you have been able to provide evidence that you have stopped smoking. That may work a lot better than just trying to impose these taxes on folks. Certainly to fund those programs, there's going to be taxes that would arise. Likely that would involve taxes on cigarettes. Ultimately, I think that would make sense. If there's more people smoking, there's a greater need for smoking cessation. And also with more people smoking, there would be more funding for smoking cessation programs. And so having that linkage, that earmark for those revenues would make a lot of sense. And I think that would be a program that would be a lot more effective at discouraging consumption of cigarettes over time than just imposing these taxes.
But to some degree, that's the kind of thing that's going on without the incentive programs, which, as you say, we could sort of do that anytime and maintain the tax strategy, because there's another element to this we haven't talked about. I mean, on the one hand, we might want to discourage individuals from practicing this, but this is not about the state telling me how to be a better person. There are real public health consequences to smoking, to alcoholism and alcohol and drug abuse. They're public health, and they all cost us in terms of lost productivity. And we then, as a public, need to say something about this. So if you're costing me more because you're smoking, it might be an individual decision, but you're costing me money. And I think you should put something in the public coffers that contribute either to smoking cessation programs or anything else that we, the public, think is necessary and required as a function of government. So, yeah, pay up because you're costing me money.
But ultimately, these are leading to, I think that there's valid arguments to that. And I think we as a voting citizenry should certainly be more involved in that type of discussion and look to the literature to see what programs have actually been most effective. Certainly there have been some increases in healthcare costs, and we have made healthcare more of a public policy expenditure more so than just pure private. And as a result of that, certainly there are some spillover effects from an individual's consumption of cigarettes and the cost of healthcare to the public at large. And so, certainly we can look into those options. But I think that this is where we really need to look at, well, should this be a federal tax and a federal program? Should it be a state program and taxes? Or should it be more at the local level? And ultimately what we find throughout a lot of this research is these types of programs are best implemented at the local level. Not only that, because local level politicians and other elected officials are closer to those people. They know more of the people in their community than does one of our federal elected officials. But then also, these taxes, it allows for experimentation. We don't have the solutions, clearly. We haven't developed the solutions in the public policy sphere in terms of how to address these problems the best, because they have failed time and time again. And so having these types of policies at the local level, allowing each locality to enact their own policies, tax policy and programs to reduce smoking or any other activity, that's where we're going to have more experimentation. There'll be somebody that ultimately has a success, and then the others ultimately can learn from that.
I'm talking to Todd Nesbitt, one of the editors of a book called For Your Own Good, Taxes, Paternalism, and Fiscal Discrimination in the 21st Century. But when you say that, I mean, so first of all, I take your larger point that there is some role here that public policy discussion can play, and taxation can be a part of this, not necessarily for personal health and welfare, but also because of public health is a thing, and all of these things bear on truly on public health. But if you do it all at the local level, don't you run into your problem, which is if I tax your cigarettes here in Durham, you're just going to go buy them in Raleigh.
Yes, and that then leads to certainly there's a lot of cross-border shopping that can happen, and that can make it more complex for sure. And so it's really a balance of really – there is no first best policy, I would suggest.
But wouldn't you say, though, let's take plastic bags, for instance. That's another one that you take on in this thing. We know that the production and then the disposal of plastic is a problem. It's an environmental problem to produce and dispose of plastic. We recognize that. One way to do that, we think, is to encourage people to use plastic bags, not to use plastic bags. But talk about the programs and the ways that you think they have been counterproductive so far.
Yeah, so with plastic bags, we have to consider what is the alternative. So if we ban or tax heavily so-called single-use plastic bags, what are individuals going to use in their place? And then measure, is that actually an improvement for the environment or not? We saw some, and this is an area where there's been a lot of anecdotal evidence, very little solid academic research in this area. So I'll share several anecdotes here with this. Down in Austin, Texas, there was, after their plastic bag ban that they imposed, there was almost a one-for-one substitution over that next year from single-use plastic bags to multi-use plastic totes. These totes are thicker, the plastic is, and ultimately so much thicker that they would, in order to be carbon equivalent, so they use the same amount of carbon or have the same amount of carbon emissions as plastic single-use plastic bags, those bags would have to be used 11 times. But again, there was a substitution almost one for one, suggesting that people were using them maybe 1 to 1.2 times. And so ultimately, that's led to more pollution.
Well, but that, if I can stop you there, that might just be initially, if you're in the transition, you've got everybody dumping their single use and moving to the new one. And then over time, once people start using them more times, you would see a different ratio.
Possibly that there could be over a longer period of time people could possibly change their behavior and how they use those bags. Certainly for all the shorter term evidence that we've seen, that hasn't been the case. There's also, you could switch to paper bags. Paper bags use a lot more energy in their production, and they generate a lot of extra pollutants as well in the production process. Of course, they do biodegrade more easily, so there could be some longer-term gains there. Reusable cloth bags are another example. Ultimately, again, carbon equivalent, these would have to be used about 130 times to be equivalent to a single-use plastic bag. But even beyond that, there's some other health consequences that can result. As roughly based on some surveys, there's roughly 97% of people who use these reusable cloth bags. They don't ever wash them. And yet they're putting meats and vegetables that they're buying at their grocery store. This has led to increases in salmonella and E. coli, admissions to the hospitals. And San Francisco has experienced a big increase.
Do we have a direct link between the dirty bag and the salmonella, or is it just?
So this was for the year after San Francisco imposed their ban. There was a 46% increase in deaths attributable to foodborne illnesses, and there in that same city, a significant increase. Now, there could be some other confounding factors, certainly. And that's why, again, at this stage, all the large part of the evidence on paper or the bans and taxes for single-use plastic bags tends to be a bit more anecdotal rather than where we can definitely link these causal factors.
Todd, all of these essays really do, and as you've pointed out here in just this conversation, we need to think more deeply when it comes to public policy about the consequences and then measure after the fact kind of how things have turned out and see if we can directly correlate some of the consequences to the action. But this, what you're suggesting here, is some deep thought about public policy, because we do have a right, because we understand that public health has to do with a national highway system that has encouraged automobile traffic. We don't notice that, but that's our tax dollars picking a winner. Mm-hmm. Our tax dollars have picked the winner, the automobile and fossil fuel. And it's so, we don't even think about it anymore. So all of these things have been public policy questions. What about the rhetoric that goes around this? Because what we hear instead of this measured speech and call for deliberate consideration that you're calling for, phrases like the nanny state, as though we're not responsible for our own behavior, and as though all of these policies are about personal behavior and have no impact on public policy and public health. Do you think we should be changing the tone and the rhetoric around this to have a more reasoned conversation?
I wish we could, across all policies, remove a lot of the rhetoric that we observe, not just within taxes, but across the board. I think that's a bit of a unicorn in my mind. It's so difficult to get everybody on the same page. However, I think that shows like yours, where we're having these types of discussions, hopefully over time can help nudge that a little bit, I guess, in the direction of let's have an educated, thoughtful approach to seeing what not only the direct effects of a policy are on the intended goal, but also a lot of the other side effects that are there.
And there are these other, again, these sort of submerged effects. I mean, the effects of the farm bill, for instance, on the way we eat, and the kind of hidden subsidies and rail subsidies that can cheaply move products across the country to encourage a kind of industrial agriculture, to encourage coal production, all of these things that we don't see that are, in a sense, coming out of our tax dollars, encouraging a certain way of behaving as Americans.
Yeah, we certainly do see both selective taxation and a lot of selective subsidization that's out there. And a lot of this, there's oftentimes a nice marketed spin that's put on how this is presented. But oftentimes there's a lot of special interest that's really behind the primary push for a particular policy. And so even if you look at the plastic bag taxes that exist out there, the grocers associations are massively behind those. They're providing a lot of funding to help encourage localities to impose those taxes, because those plastic bags cost a penny per bag to the grocer. If they can instead get the consumer to bring in their own bag, given that there's 14 billion bags used per year in California, that saves the grocers in California about $140 million a year. And that's to their bottom line. And in some areas, such as Washington, D.C., you see that it's not a tax, it's a mandated fee. And so they have to pay, consumers are supposed to pay 5 cents per bag, and that's pure revenue to the grocers itself. And so, again, there's a lot of hidden benefactors of a lot of these tax policies and subsidies that are out there that, again, we should really be aware of and think, is this ultimately then the solution that we would like to move forward with?
Todd Nesbitt is a professor of economics at Ball State University. Going to be at Campbell Law School in Raleigh on Monday, October 8th for a John Locke Foundation-sponsored event. Just ahead, the music of Black Space Afronauts. Stay tuned.